Hello and welcome to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast for the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amadé, host of World Poetry Open Mic and The Michael Amadé Show, musician, poet, and author of more books than I should mention. My collaborator and co-conspirator in this project is none other than Clifford Brooks. Cliff is the author of Athena Departs and The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics. He's a founder of the Southern Collective Experience and is a creative force behind the Blue Mountain Review. Our guest today is Stuart Deschelle. Stuart Deschelle was born in Atlantic City, New Jersey. He's the author of Good Hope Road, a National Poetry Series selection, Evenings and Avenues, Dig Safe, Backwards Days, and the forthcoming Children with Enemies, and the pamphlets Animate Earth and Touch Monkey, and the chapbook Standing on Z. His poems have appeared in The Atlantic, Agni, The New Republic, Slate, Kenyon Review, Plowshares, and anthologies including Essential Poems, Hammer and Blaze, Pushcart Prize, and Garrison Keillor's Good Poems. A recipient of awards from the NEA, the North Carolina Arts Council, and the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, he teaches in the MFA program in creative writing at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. This is a fantastic interview, and it really has a lot of great things you can pull from it. So without any further ado, here is our interview with Stuart Deschelle.
Welcome. Tonight on This Business of Music and Poetry, we have a special treat with professor and poet Stuart Deschelle. Stuart, how are you doing, boss?
I'm doing very well. Nice to be on the show here, Cliff and Michael also. Hello to you both.
It's great to see you. And I've gone to a deep dive of your life in poetry, and I've not seen much talk about your youth in Atlantic City. Could you tell us what growing up there was like and how it played into you as a poet?
Well, you know, there are early poems of mine, and I keep going back to Atlantic City, but you're absolutely right, because the poems are kind of implicit about Atlantic City rather than explicit. Like, if there's a shore in my poems, the shore is always going to be the shore where I grew up. But I don't think I ever mention Atlantic City itself, or maybe even other details of it, you know, that might suggest it rather than another kind of failed resort sort of place. But it did shape me, I think. You know, Atlantic City was a resort in decline when I grew up there. It hadn't yet brought in legalized gambling, which hastened its decline. There was actually quite a bit of illegalized gambling in those days in Atlantic City, and always had been. But you know, that seemed to be under control. It was, I think Atlantic City was, you know, slightly corruptive influence on me, in the sense that, you know, in Atlantic City on the boardwalk, I mean, everybody had a scam or a con, and, you know, there were like all these bingo parlors and auctions and other places. You know, it was still like a going place when I was a kid. You know, the boardwalk in the summertime was full of people, but it declined pretty rapidly. And I don't know if you've ever been there, but today it's, you know, you go for a walk on the boardwalk and it's really a very changed place. It's really quite desolate, and a lot of the casinos are closed.
Now, as you began to develop as a poet and as a person, really a little known but fascinating moment in your life as far as just the amount of work you did there and the people you met. And of course, I'm talking about Boston. Tell us how, you know, we see how Atlantic City kind of set the foundation of you, but what did Boston and those folks you ran into, how did they play a part in you as a person and poet?
Well, I think that was like pretty much my maturation as a poet took place in Boston. And I still look back on those days very affectionately. I had went from Atlantic City to Antioch College in Ohio, where I was a student, and obviously. And then I went to the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. And after graduating Iowa, I was pretty young then. I think I was 25 or maybe 26 when I graduated Iowa. And actually, I believe now that I think about it, I was actually maybe even 24. I decided that that Boston would be a good city to move to. I actually had no real connections there. I mean, I had some cousins who lived in the area there, but, you know, they weren't original Bostonians. They had been educated at various universities and stayed on to do work there. But Boston, back in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s when I lived there, was a very open literary community. And people weren't big on reading their resumes to each other or throwing their prestige around. There were many events and readings, and afterwards, all the different writers who were around, and poets especially, would all go out together. And you'd see people like Derek Walcott and Seamus Heaney and Thomas Lux or C.K. Williams in the years that he was there, Rosanna Warren. There were, you know, wonderful poets who were my friends in those days, like Murray Howe and the late Lucy Brock Broido, Oskold Melnichuk, a novelist and poet and editor of Anya magazine and Humanitarian, many other writers of that time as well. And both their presence and their work informed me, and the fact that they really took me seriously also. You know, it's kind of startling. I went back to Cambridge, where I'd lived, and gave a reading at the Blacksmith House, and in the audience were people like Lloyd Schwartz and Robert Pinsky and Gail Mazur and others, and all of them who had taken, you know, I said at the beginning of the reading how kind everyone had been to me, and how was it that they ever really took me seriously, until I think Gail said, "Enough, Stuart, just start reading." And, you know, you know, you realize later on sometimes how much gratitude you have for people. Sometimes in the heat of it, I mean, it's not like you're not grateful, but you don't realize until later on how kind people were to me. You know, when there was absolutely no reason to, really, except human goodness.
In Boston, under the scrutiny of kind peers, how did you, was it during that period in time where you feel like you felt like you found your voice, like, this is me? And if so, like, how do you describe your poetic voice?
Well, that's a hard thing. I think you're absolutely right again. You did take a deep dive here. You know, I mean, I had a voice when I was writing poems all along, you know, or maybe voices. When I was early in my writing, I tended to write in various persona, which was probably a good idea, since I didn't really have much to say from my own persona or experience. And I really recommend that for young writers, that they, you know, if you don't have a life really that you can write about yet, you know, to try to, you know, be imaginative in what you write. At least you can get yourself on the page. I'm not suggesting I wrote really wonderful poems like that, but I've always maintained that as a writer, that I feel like I have a voice and I have voices, and just as I have a self and I have selves, and you know, the voice of any kind of writer is a construction. You know, I mean, you create the voice, you know, that you have. Part of it is whatever personality you have, but others, part of it is what personality you want to have.
Exactly. And,
you try to project. Perhaps your voice is a better version of yourself. I mean, I think we see that in many writers that we meet, maybe on your own show, perhaps, but, you know, whose work is very different than perhaps their voice or other attitudes about them. But, you know, I mean, it's all a construction, right? I mean, the self is a construction too. Right. And, you know, I mean, it's something that, of course, you know, modernist poets were delving into, like Eliot, you know, I mean, let's mm-hmm. rock, but you know, trying to find a kind of self among selves, you know.
So you took your voice, and you, it was heard there in Boston. You left then or after that and did some extensive research in Paris. Could you tell us about those years?
Well, you know, I never I may have misguided you a little bit on that. I never really lived in Paris other than being there 2 months at a time or right. a week or two at a time. I've been in Paris, I don't know, maybe 43 or 44 times in my
life. There you go, man.
20 years old. But I've never really been able to stay more than a couple of months at a time because of, you know, children or work considerations or money. As well. But, you know, that so that all really took place over a period of time from when I was, as I said before, when I was 20 years on, you know, until like just a month or so ago when I was also over there doing some work and trying to complete another project. But the work I did in Paris is about the defensive walls of the city and how they changed the way the city is today. And I kind of like that thing of being able to stand in a place and know that that same place existed, you know, like for 2,000 years throughout history and what might have occurred on that very same corner. And Paris, it always had a special place in my psyche because my grandparents emigrated there from Central Europe and before coming to the United States. And I grew up with this notion that like everything was really better in Paris, from the wind, you know, to the sky, to the, you know, to of course the baguette. You know, but and in many cases, some cases, that's true. But I'm a kind of frustrated urbanist. Late in my college career, I took a course from a man named Rick Francaviglia, who I understand still teaches out in the Pacific Northwest. And he was an urbanist and was very interested and got me interested in why cities and towns exist where they do. And perhaps that I had his course not as a fulfilling requirement to graduate in my last semester in college, you know, it might have changed my own trajectory. But I've been working on this book for like 20 years. I have no I have no hurry to finish it up. At a certain point, I had an agent who was excited about it, but you know, fashions changed, trends changed, editors have changed, and agents have changed.
Right.
But I keep pursuing this project and trying to find a new structure for it. And, you know, it's sort of urban exploration, history, personal history. It took place during the, many of the episodes took place during the decline and death of my father, and also the decline and sundering of my marriage. And, you know, and obviously time afterwards has, not obviously, but has taken my mother and many friends as well. So, you know, the story continues. But then I came down to North Carolina after Boston when my first book, Good Hope Road, won the National Poetry Series. The university asked me if I would come and fill in for one of their professors who had gotten Alan Shapiro, who now teaches or taught at Chapel Hill. I think he's just gone emeritus. That if I would fill in for him while he was on a Lila Wallace grant, a blessed thing back in the day, I believe, where he got several years of support from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Foundation. And I came down here for 3 years to Greensboro, North Carolina, the MFA program in creative writing. And I really enjoyed my colleagues, such as, you know, Jim Clark and Fred Chappell and Lee Zacharias, and who were teaching, and Michael Parker, who were in the same year I did. And then there were a lot of retirements, and Michael and I stayed on. And now Michael's recently retired. I mean, I saw you smile, you know, all you audio listeners were looking at each other visually here on Zoom. We record, but yeah, Michael Parker's a very fine novelist. And I have, you know, wonderful colleagues now who are teaching as well. And so with a year in New Mexico, I've managed to remain here for the last 30 years of my career, which is astonishing because I'm only 26.
I wasn't going to say a day beyond 24, man. I wasn't. I don't know. What is your secret, man? And your secrets are kind of what I'm very much what I'm interested in the classroom. Because with the wealth of knowledge, I like how, again, to see where someone comes from, to see where they end up. And when you get into the classroom, how do you tackle the beast of poetry for your students?
Well, you know, I try to explain in very kind of sometimes very simplified terms, you know, how poetry is structured. And I don't necessarily mean, you know, the form, you know, like traditional poetic forms, but to try to see in the poems they read and the poems they write that there are patterns that they make, that there are ways that unintentionally, intentionally, consciously, subconsciously, unconsciously, what have you, that, you know, people create structure. I mean, everything creates some kind of a structure. You know, spiders make webs, you know, dogs scratch.
Right.
You know, I'm joking, obviously, but structure guides everything. And the more I've written, the more I've kind of tried to understand as both reader and teacher that structure is not just something that's like, you know, formal and dry, but structure is actually magic. I mean, craft is craft. It's like witchcraft. It's, you know, it has an alchemical appeal to it. I mean, we make words, we make phrases, we make poems, and we try to make them deathless, right? I mean, our complaints, our songs, our chants, you know, but it's the structure we make of it. And I think talking about structure and getting people to think about it, you know, is really important. And it's important from the start. I'm going to be teaching an undergraduate modern poetry course. And, you know, the first thing I'm going to talk about with them is, you know, is like how to mark up a poem and what to just to notice, you know, hey, look, the title, what's going on? You know, what does that mean? What kind of a title is this? How does it inform the text? What is it suggesting? Is it nuanced? Is it, you know, does it have a big arrow or a spotlight on the material? Or is it just sort of like a title that's bland at first, like In the Waiting Room by Elizabeth Bishop? And
yeah,
the poem, you realize that it's a really heavy title that has great resonance to it. So, you know, and then, you know, what is the first line? What are the first words? You know, to think about lines, you know, that's what makes poems. And I'm not talking about prose poems here, but that's what makes most poems different from, you know, prose experience, is that poetry is written in lines, and lines have some kind of adherence usually to music or structure, always structure, obviously, but form, you know, maybe they're formal, maybe their lines are iambic, maybe the lines are in a formal pattern, or maybe the lines are free verse, or maybe the lines are just kind of like back in the day, what, you know, it was called breath lines of poetry.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that's where the breath comes in. I mean, you know, why do poets break their lines? That's, you know, I think a question that, you know, is important to everyone who reads poetry or whatever. And I think if a reader gets a greater idea of the structure of poetry, the reader then can begin to understand, more about the resonance of the words and the meaning of them, and get beyond trying to like graft on some highfalutin meaning to something that they don't really understand.
Right.
I think you're making a great point here when we're talking about form. And this was something that I, as a young creative person tried to rebel against for a while until I knew better. I don't want to do things like anybody else had done anything. And then I heard a quote, and I can't remember who said it, and I'm probably going to screw this thing up, but it's something along the lines of subtlety and nuance don't seem to blend with this particular planet's brand of gravity. But somehow using form and using genre, we're able to use those things again in a way that people can understand. I've grown to have such an appreciation of form. Do you find that there's people making the mistake I did when I was younger and trying to rebel against form early on? Or is this a...
Well, I think it's really important to rebel against form. When I was coming up as a poet, I mean, it wasn't my generation, but the generation ahead of me, the older people, they published books called like Naked Poetry, and these books were intentionally wonderful anthology, but all of it was kind of trying to break form, and that's fine. I mean, I think it's always has to be rebelled against. You take poet like W.S. Merwin, who early, kind of in early mid-career, drops all punctuation from his poems from a moment forward, I think halfway through one of his books. I'm not sure whether it's The Moving Target or not. And creates a whole different sense of lineation, but he creates his own structures, within it. I guess when I use the word form, I like to think about, form's a huge word, so I like to think of structure as being the bigger word than form.
Okay.
And I think of form, I think maybe of things that other people, like you say, have already done, that everyone's written a pantoum or everyone's written, in this kind of a manner. That's why, I want to break the back of this. But, there has to be something that we rebel against or have tension against. I started reading poems that were canonical because I had that kind of a teacher in high school. And then when I got to college, I was lucky enough to study with a man named Ira Sadoff, who's a fine poet. And Ira, started bringing in poets like Bill Knott and Merwin and Adrian Rich, James Wright, and people like that. And it certainly changed my mind. I've been reading like Yeats and Robert Graves, and those were like, the more contemporary. Dylan Thomas might have been the most, contemporary, poet I'd read. I think there's a ludicrous picture in my high school yearbook of me holding the collected poems of Dylan Thomas in my hand, wearing one of my teacher's tweed jackets.
That's all. Now it's you're taking your cumulative knowledge and skill and your voice, many voices, into your actually two new projects that you have coming up. One is a collection of your poetry. Let's first talk about that, and then we're going to talk about the second collaborative one. So tell us about this upcoming book that you have on.
Well, I have a book called The Lookout Man coming out. It's coming out in March 28th from the Phoenix Poets Series at the University of Chicago Press that also published my last book, Children with Enemies. And I love the cover of it. It's a photograph of a horseman that's either getting off the horse or looking down, but, slightly. The ironic cover to temper the work a little bit, but
right.
The book is, you know, a collection of my poems, essentially, that I've written over the last 4 or 5 years. And many of them are poems that have titles called lines. And they're poems that address, you know, various subjects from ships at sea to mountaineering. It's kind of more of a wider-ranging book than my previous work. And I would say or venture that it's more of a work of the imagination than it is of recollection, though there are some poems. Of course, there are some hurt love poems that, you know, are my signature revenge on people. I mean, you know, they say irony is the defense of the weak. I think being a poet is the defense of the weak. You know, that's how you get back at those who you feel have wronged you. So I have some mean love poems at the towards the end of the book. But otherwise, I think it's further ranging in landscapes and even in voices. One of the poems concerns artists and one of the founding members of the Ukrainian feminist organization Femen, that was greatly repressed in Ukraine in Russia, and moved a lot of its activities to the West. And her name was Oksana Shako, and one of my poems concerns her. But it's also right next to a poem about an impossible French friend of mine named Hubert Desmarais. And so maybe it's a mixture of some familiar grounds from my backyard to some alpine summits that I've not climbed so much as gotten near of, let's say, when I was in the Alps and Switzerland and France some years ago.
Now, we're going to come back to that collection, but I want to talk first, before we do, about your collaborative project that you have on deck that's got several layers to it. Tell us about that, man.
Well, I think I can actually be more excited about that because that's outside myself. To be quite honest, I've never really been good at talking about my own work. And I've always actually been kind of suspicious of writers who understand their own work too well.
Yeah, right. I got you. You know, I feel that.
A lot of people like that, you know, they really understand their own work and explain it to me a lot. And, you know, that to me is like treading water. It's not so good, but I could be, you know, even as I was talking to you, I could hear myself fumble and say, is this one of these things that I want to get out of this? But I don't think it need be so much as
right.
A little bit flat when I talk about that, because I think the intensity goes for me into the creation of those poems, many of them being short lyrics. But speaking of which, I was at this place in Spain, in Mojácar, Spain, an artist's foundation there. And while I was there, I met some really brilliant writers and visual artists. And among them was a man named Cyril Kane. And Cyril Kane is a French filmmaker and photographer. And I would do most of my work in the mornings, as I usually do there. And he would do his work in the afternoons because he was doing some photographing and filming out on the desert of Andalusia, which is where is the province that Mojácar is located. And Mojácar is on the sea. And funnily enough, it's also where a lot of what were called the spaghetti westerns were made, like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or even the first version of The Magnificent Seven.
Yep.
And it was a town they call now Fort Bravo, and you pay to get into this place in the Spanish desert, and you see all these buildings. And it was very disconcerting to me because I realized the town was based on La Mesilla, New Mexico, which is where the town I lived next to when I taught in New Mexico, mm-hmm. in New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. And it was very odd to see this desert landscape that was so close to a landscape I lived in for a year that I wasn't entirely comfortable in either. I wrote a poem then that was in my book, Backwards Days, you know, that began with a remark that someone had made. It begins, out there we lived in a few, my friend had said, you just can't live in a view, a view is magnificent, but you can't live in it. And I didn't really know what to do with New Mexico in the year that I had lived there. But in any case, Cyril and I would go out to the desert in the afternoon, and he would, shoot film, and I would just, hang out by the car and, take pictures on my iPhone.
Right.
And our pictures of him taking pictures. And he suggested later on that we collaborate on something, based on our experiences together. And I told him that I don't really collaborate with people, but that I'd be willing to write a poem that was set in the desert. And I wasn't sure which desert it would be set in or where or why, but that I would try to write something that would kind of be like two trains running in the same direction, let us say.
Right.
And so, lo and behold, I was able to do such a thing because I've never been good at doing assignments. As a teacher, I give students assignments all the time, but as a student, I was never really very good at fulfilling an assignment within maybe a month, 2 months, a year later, maybe 10 years later, I actually, fulfilled that assignment in a much better way. But, I was glad my teachers were very lenient. In any case, I wrote this poem, and we decided that what we should do is bring this poem to bookstores and galleries with his photographs, and that we would try to find a publisher to publish it as a chapbook, which would be perfect for a gallery run. As both kind of catalog and chapbook. And, what wound up happening was we decided we needed a translator. And at first we had some trouble finding that person. And then I beseeched my friend and neighbor, Laurent Estapé, who is a trained musician from the Conservatory of Lausanne and is a composer of new music and performs all over, the world with his ensemble, if he would take a stab at translating it. Now, Laurent is from Lausanne, so he adds a different spin to this because he speaks French, but he is from the Vaud region of Switzerland, which is, kind of a little different than maybe Parisian French would be.
Right.
As Laurent started getting into this, he started bringing his own energy, and then he composed a set of musical pieces to accompany the photographs and the poem. I brought this idea to Andrew Salters, the publisher and editor of Unicorn Press, that had done a chapbook of my work, Standing on Z, and he does some remarkable handmade books. And Andrew thought about it for a few minutes and thought, hey, I'd like to break the back of the book. Let's make an accordion book out of this.
Yeah.
And Laurent already wanted a 7-inch vinyl rather than a CD, and
So
we decided we would put a 7-inch vinyl recording in the sleeve in the back. And so we now have four collaborators, more or less, of a project that started out with really, really two. But I think Cyril Kane was the original energy in all of this. And as I see it, in a lot of ways, we have the music, we have the photography, and we have the poem. But, my poem actually feels like the least of it. It feels almost like sort of maybe a kind of catalyst for the translation and the music, but you know, for me, the photography will be at the heart of the book as well.
Now, tell us what the project is called again and how we can get our hands
on it. I'm sorry. It's called Andalusian Visions, mm-hmm. and it will be published by Unicorn Press in June of 2022. And you probably will be able to find it by going to the Unicorn Press website. Or maybe it'll be up on, you know, one of the dread, conglomerate booksellers as well, as I think we all have to do with our books in order to get them into the hands of people. But it will for sure be there, and it will be at Scuppernong Books for sure in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Right on. Well, now that we know about that, put a bow on it, I want to scoot back around to the Lookout Man and ask if you would ask humbly if you would read a poem from it, please.
Okay, I'd like to do that very much, actually.
Awesome.
With the COVID and all, I haven't really had a chance to road test these poems as much as possible.
Right on.
In the past. I'll actually read the last poem from the book, and it's called Lines Along a Wild Place. That was my dog groaning back there.
I'm sure he's a big fan. I'm sure there's a groan, positive groan.
Cats are better critics, I've always said, than dogs. Good dog. All I can do is like say it in a certain tone of voice, and he likes everything.
Okay. All right.
You know, paddle craps in your typewriter back in the day. You don't like your work.
That's hardcore, bro.
Yeah.
All right.
Lines Along a Wild Place. I walked through the enterprise of weeds. A crow for each of us stood mounted on a fence. Sometimes I miss everyone I ever loved when their faces reflect in the hard, wide leaves of the magnolia. Their names like blossoms, and their lives once so real and fragrant, now like handkerchiefs beneath the trees. If my dog were alive, he might piss on them, and I would have to yell at him not to if anyone were around. If anyone were around, I would say I had momentous news to tell, but forget what it is. I will ask the dogwoods to remind me what it means to live along the edges of the woods, to be promiscuous but bear white flowers.
That's outstanding. That's tell us the name of that poem again.
It's called Lines Along a Wild Place. And it was a previous dog that looked a lot like this dog.
All right. Yeah. And there's a meaning inside that is too, man.
There is too. Yep.
Stuart DeShale, this has been an honor to sit with you this evening. Now, The Lookout Man, that's coming out in 2022 as well.
March 28th, 2022.
Right.
And I'll be giving a number of readings in different places. And I guess I'll have to get my website, stuartdeshalepoetry.com, back updated since the last reading tours. But I'm hoping to be reading a bunch in North Carolina, maybe even coming down to Atlanta. Always glad to.
Man, we would love to hook that up. I'll talk to you later about that because I've got some ideas.
Great. And if anyone out there is also interested in hosting an event for the Andalusian Visions book, an event that will also include music and photography, which can be a great draw, I think, for a gallery or bookstore. You know, you get Laurent, this guy in Paris is going to have us in his bar on National Music Day in June. And, you know, Laurent will be blowing the saxophone outside in the Rue Quincampoix. And if that will bring people into his bar, I don't know what will.
Right.
I'm sure people will come anyway, but that's a great venue also. The Brooklyn Bar, you can find them on Instagram.
Gotcha.
That's beautiful. Now, really quickly, Stuart, one question kind of as we wrap up here. We have a lot of people who are listening to this that are poets, are creative people, but some of them are at least feel as if they are always kind of reaching for their vision, but it's never quite happening for them yet. And we're all practicing the craft and trying to develop. What advice would you impart to those who are, you know, working in the practice, but have yet to kind of master the master it yet? You know, what advice would you have to impart to those people?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not a simple thing, but I would probably say persistence. You know, I mean, if you believe in yourself, or even if you don't believe in yourself, but you've gotten yourself in the pickle of being a writer and been doing this for a long time and invested a lot of time and maybe money into all this, then, you know, persistence does it. You know, I was very young, I think I told you, when I finished graduate school and moved to Boston, but it was 14 years until my first book came out. And so, you know, fortunately, it won the National Poetry Series and it was able to gain some attention. And I was able to, like, you know, as I said, you know, garner a job and all of that. So, but nonetheless, you know, 14 years is a long time to, you know, I didn't, you know, maybe I started sending a book out a couple of years after I left Iowa. And, you know, I had a lot of disappointments and a lot of being a finalist for things. And, you know, I was pretty bummed out. And I guess I was like 38 by then. But for me, I had been doing this a long time and waiting, you know, I was kind of like, you know, waiting to have a passport of some sort into this world I had already, you know, this, you know, foreign country of poetry that I had entered, tried to make my own. So yeah, persist out there, you know. You know, don't let other people take away your dreams from you. And the other thing is America's a big country with lots of different presses and lots of different ways, and poetry can mean different things to different people. And, you know, there's, I think it's hard to, there's no measure of success. And I think maybe some people at a certain point, you know, saw there was a way of being successful. But I think all of that's changed. And, you know, really, when you think about it, poetry is one of the most, if not the most democratic of art forms. You really don't need anything to do it. You don't even need to write it down. You know, you can just speak it. You know, you don't need to, you know, it's been around from the beginning of time, and it'll be around by, you know, imagine till the end of time. It's flexible. It's democratic. It doesn't just come now from like New York and Boston and San Francisco, where all the presses were. You know, it comes from everywhere now, where people are publishing really fine books. You know, some people may say there are no standards anymore. Maybe that's true too. But, you know, maybe the standards weren't the greatest standards either. You know, maybe the people who made those standards I didn't like too much either. But maybe for different reasons. I don't know.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending time with us. And we want to say thank you to Stuart Deschelle for a great conversation. We really loved having you on. You can find Stuart at stuartdeschellepoetry.com. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or at southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find myself at michaelamade.com, worldpoetryopenmic.com, or worldpoetrymagazine.com. Until next time, remember to be yourself. The world needs your authenticity. Do the hard work and conquer your obstacles creatively. Remember to follow your heart, for it's easy to lose your head in this business of music and poetry.